As I've mentioned before, many farmers who owned massive plantations before the war were financially ruined by the end of it. And for various reasons, the end of free slave labor certainly had an impact, but there were other factors. Before the war, the South had been king of cotton, and were depended on all over the world for its cotton. But in 1861, the South made a move they thought would strengthen the Confederacy. They decided to starve the world of cotton, believing Europe would become so desperate they'd give the Confederacy full recognition and hopefully even help them win the war against the Union. But this plan backfired because the South depended on the money from the cotton being exported, as it was their primary source of income. So it turned out to be a disastrous move. During the war, Britain started buying cotton from Egypt. So when the war ended, the South was no longer the king of cotton. They had fierce competition that caused prices to dramatically drop. And there were also high taxes after the war, because the South had gotten into serious debt to pay for the cost. North Carolina's debt alone was more than $9 million. Needless to say, the South was financially wrecked. Many who were rich before the war had to sell land, sometimes at the cost of the taxes. Land was cheap. After 1865, a number of Northerners moved South. Some were wealthy and helped the economy by starting factories and hospitals. But there were opportunities even for those with very little money, who bought land for dirt cheap and became wealthy landowners and farmers themselves. Those Northerners were nicknamed carpetbaggers, because they often moved to the South with nothing more than carpet bag in their hand. And some were accused of filling up their carpet bags with as much Southern money as possible before they head back north. Southern sentiment towards those so-called carpetbaggers were mixed. Some were grateful for the investments in their communities, and others were suspicious and believed carpetbaggers were corrupt and were only there to take advantage of the Southern people.
Hello, my name is Darlene.
And I'm Melody.
This is Hard Times and True Crimes.
We're not drinking coffee today. No. For one thing, it's late afternoon. If I drink coffee this late, I will be
not
up all night.
Yeah. And I have a sore throat, so I'm drinking tea and lemon stuff. We're going to tell you the story today of Nell Cropsey from Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And Melody and I collaborated on this one.
We did. We were asked to do an article for a local homeschool magazine, which at the time that this recording is released, I believe the magazine will have been printed. And so we wrote part of this story in there, and we're finishing it here on the podcast.
Yeah, we left them with like a cliffhanger.
Yes.
So hopefully they're all coming here now to listen.
Yes. And this is another local story from North Carolina.
The part that Melody is going to tell, I don't necessarily know about, and vice versa. We're overall familiar with it. But we will be each learning things.
Yes,
we have. The other has researched.
We have collaborated, and we both took our parts to research.
Right,
and some of that overlapped, and some did not. I hope I have some things in there to surprise you with.
Yeah, same. So Ella Maud Cropsey, nicknamed Nellie or Nell, was born in July of 1882, the third of nine children. Mary and William Cropsey had six daughters and three sons. And they actually had another child. I'm not sure if it was a boy or girl, but that child, as was common at the time, did pass away. Nell's dad, William, was from an old Cropsey family in Brooklyn, New York. He was a farmer, but his crops, they just didn't quite pay the bills up there. He didn't have great land. He had to subsidize his income and work for the city as an official. And he didn't really see himself being able to climb the ladder there. And he was just kind of overshadowed by his brother, who was a judge, and his dad, who was very successful, stuck in a middle class life.
And I guess he had higher aspirations.
Yeah, he did. And well, he had a large family for one.
He needed some money.
He desperately needed to make money to support. His heart was actually in farming. Like I said before, his land was not great. And the average acre in New York at the time was $1,200 an acre, which that was a lot of money.
I was going to say that sounds a lot more than I expected you to say.
Mm-hmm. $1,200 an acre, which was astronomical at the time.
Yes, because like even like in the 70s and 80s, you could buy land for $1,500 an acre if you bought a lot at a time. So
right.
I'm surprised by that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the South, following the Civil War, we've talked about this before, how land was cheap. Even prime property. The South got into some serious debt during the Civil War to pay for the cost of the war. Inflation was insane.
Yeah, I bet so.
And so many who were rich before the war had to sell their land now to pay taxes. Sometimes they sold their land just for the price of the taxes, which was like $25 sometimes.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. After 1865, a number of Northerners moved South to buy up land or to lease plantations because, you know, if these planters were able to hang on to their land, they probably didn't have money to put into to planting.
Right.
So they would, you know, lease the land just to be able to keep it. You didn't have to be rich either to get this opportunity because William Cropsey was not rich. He was a, you know, middle class New Yorker. And one day he saw this ad in the newspaper for some cheap land in Elizabeth City. And he realized that in southern climate, he could grow bumper crops all year round and become successful at doing what he really wanted to do. So in 1898, William, along with his wife and children, left the big city and they moved to 1109 Riverside Avenue. And it was a 65-acre plantation on the banks of the Pasquotank River.
In Elizabeth City.
Yep. North Carolina. William was to become a potato farmer. And to this day, potatoes are really big in Elizabeth City. In fact, you know how we have the fall festival?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have the potato festival
three days
a year.
I want to go.
I do too. I think it would be a lot like our fall festival. There's music, local vendors, actually a lot of rides, you know, delicious food.
That's what I always go for, the food.
So, and I think it's in May every year. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Their new house was named Seven Pines, and it was beautiful. It's still standing to this day. So I'm going to add some pictures to our Facebook group, maybe our Instagram. We're not as active over there, but we might.
Yeah. We definitely need to take a trip there for the festival and then go see the house.
I would love that. So by the way, if you like seeing pictures to go along with these stories, make sure that you join us over on our Facebook group,
yes.
Hard Times and True Crimes. And please feel free to post comments and interact with us there. Despite some of the older children, especially Nell, not looking forward to this move, they all adjusted really well in their southern environment. I mean, they were older, so mm-hmm. I'm sure they had their friends and, their school.
Pick up and leave everything.
Yeah, and that wasn't easy. But I think it would have been hard not to like their new home, living right on the water with boats they were free to row out on whenever they wanted to. Sometimes the girls would go out on the river in these rowboats and throw out an anchor and they'd lay out in the boat and read.
Oh, that sounds glorious. I would love to do that.
Just imagine that cool breeze and that gentle rocking in the water. Yeah. And their new house also was pretty incredible. Balconies, wraparound porch to sit out on. And of course, that was probably Miss Cropsey's favorite place. She'd take her needlework out there. And Mr. Cropsey reading his newspaper. I can just see it.
Yeah. Paradise.
Not to mention, another perk was that being new to the city, the family quickly gained popularity.
Oh, sure.
Because in New York, William, like I said before, you know, he had been kind of overshadowed. But here, he was finding success independent of his family name.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, William himself would be elected judge in Pasquotank County.
Okay.
So the older kids, they occupied their time with new friends, roller skating, going to the ice cream parlor, the local theater, hometown dances. There was plenty there for them to get into.
What really surprised me about that was the roller skating.
Yes.
Because I had no idea that it went back that far.
Right.
I'm thinking 1940s and 50s for roller skating. And when I saw that part, I was like, what?
Yeah, very early 1900s. William's daughters, nicknamed Nell and Ollie, they were beautiful, fresh faces in Elizabeth City. And it didn't take long at all for them to be noticed by the local gentlemen.
Of course, yes.
They were asked out and flirted with plenty, even at church.
Well, that was probably the place to meet.
Right. Ollie began a relationship with this local boy named Roy Crawford, and she liked him okay, well enough. He was a good friend, but there were no real sparks.
Yeah.
And then Nell, when she was 17, she met 23-year-old James, or Jim, Wilcox, the son of the local sheriff, Thomas Wilcox. Well, he had been the local sheriff a few years prior. Jim was actually 6 years older than Nell, which back then I don't think would have raised any eyebrows.
Oh, or the fact that she was 17 and he was 23.
Yeah.
I'm sure that today that wouldn't
go well. Yeah, that wouldn't go over very well. Different time. Jim was also really short.
Yes.
I want to say like 5 feet.
He was 5 feet two.
But what he lacked in height, he made up for with full lips and a manly mustache and southern charm. And he smoked a pipe. I don't know why that is so attractive to me.
Yeah.
By November of 1901, Jim had been courting Nell for about 2 years, a little over 2 years. By this time, Nell was 19 and Jim was 25. So Ollie and Letty, which were Nell's sisters, I love these names, by the way.
I do too, yes.
Her sisters, they would chaperone the couple. Back then, you did not go out with guys by yourself.
That would have been improper.
That would have been very improper.
And raised some eyebrows.
Right.
Of him being the impropriety of it.
Yeah, you would have been talked about.
Definitely.
You did
and
not.
Your parents probably would have gotten a visit from the preacher or something.
Right. It was socially not acceptable. Ollie and Letty could not understand what in the world Nell saw in Jim. They just felt like he lacked ambition and he dropped out of college after only a year. And what's more, they felt like he was terribly dull compared to their sister. But he made Nell laugh. And besides, she had enough personality for the both of them. Nell was lively and fun. She was chaste, but flirtatious and hopelessly optimistic. So she was just a lot of fun, it sounds like.
Yeah, I read at one point that she really loved music and the dancing. Yeah.
Yes. There was a musical institute over there. She went to a lot of concerts.
Yeah.
Her and Jim. This is where the stories start to fork a little bit. And you just have to kind of decide what rings truest, I guess. Because all we really have is witness testimony. There are no hard facts, really. We do know that the couple had issues. Jim and his side say that Nell was desperate to marry him and that she wanted a proposal from him and grew frustrated over his lollygagging. And so she started behaving mean. They say that she just got downright nasty with him, flirting with other men and like calling him names. She said she wanted her parasol back from him because he had apparently broken her parasol when she was 17. So he took it because he was going to get it repaired. But then he ended up buying her a new one and gave it to her. And now that she was kind of becoming disenchanted with him, she was like, I want my old parasol back. He felt like this was all in an attempt to make him jealous and realize you need to act fast. You know how girls are.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we play mind games. But that was the assumption, I think, the insinuation is that she was playing mind games. And I think some of that may have been partly true. Before the fall of 1901, Nell probably was interested in marriage because at that time, courtship really was for the purpose of marriage.
Yes, it was.
I don't think that you really didn't. I don't think she would have been in a relationship with him had she not.
If it wasn't going somewhere.
Exactly. And I do think that over time she became put off by Jim's lack of initiative. I mean, back then women married, they married pretty young. And once that window of time was closed, they were considered spinsters.
Spinsters, yeah.
And I don't think Nell had any intention of becoming a spinster. So it was probably a feeling of, why are you okay with wasting my time?
And I'm sure it did feel like a waste of time because, sure. Again, if she's, you know, she's getting on up there in age at 23,
right?
Or, you know, back then. And if he's not going to pop the question soon, she needs to find somebody who is.
Exactly. I've read some source material that insinuates Jim was just like a slow mover and careful, kind of a dull personality. But some of what I've read makes me think Jim might have been actually more calculating and arrogant than that.
I do think he was arrogant.
Yeah.
Just based on some of the stuff that I read.
Right. That's what I had written in my notes, especially as the story progresses. And I know I throw that narcissist word around probably every episode, but hear me out. You know, a narcissist wouldn't have a problem wasting somebody else's time. They don't care about what other people want or need or what's expected because rules don't really apply to them.
Because it's not about the other person. It's about themselves.
Right. Exactly. Everything they do centers around what they want and they need. And narcissists by nature use people until they are done with them. And then they throw them away. But don't try to walk away from a narcissist.
And that's probably a key, could be a key part of this story. Mm-hmm. So I would say keep that comment in your mind there.
In the fall of 1901, Nell started confiding in some members of her family that Jim was nice sometimes, but at other times he was eccentric, aggressive, and he had a bad temper with her.
Yes, and he was known to have a bad temper, mm-hmm. not just with her, but even at work, his workmates also said he had a bad temper.
She told her mother, her sister, and even her uncle, to name a few, that she was ready to end their courtship. They had been arguing a lot, and it just wasn't a good or happy relationship anymore, and Nell took a step back. You know, when I was that age, I didn't know how to end a relationship directly. I don't know if you were like that, but I've always been like, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Right.
It's like hard for me to do things like that. And I cared what other people might think of me. I feel like I understand Nell in this situation. Instead of directly telling Jim, she just kind of cooled off with him, ignoring him, avoiding conversation with him as much as she could without being downright rude.
Although at times it does seem like she was downright rude.
It does, I know. But, you know, she would maybe like chat with other guys in Jim's presence. I don't think she was super flirtatious, but I think trying to just throw Jim the hint, like hoping he'd get it.
Not knowing a better way to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, 19. I think she was just hoping maybe he would lose interest in her so that she didn't have to be direct.
Yeah.
But Jim was just as much a fixture at the Cropsies as he ever was, no matter how awkward things got.
And they got awkward.
And they got awkward. He visited Nell on Thursday evenings, just like always. But where she used to excitedly talk to him about her week and how giddy girls do, she just kind of ignored him. And they mostly sat in silence. Or Nell would just talk to her sister, Ollie, or whoever else happened to be there besides Jim.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ladies, I don't know about you, but over the last few years, Melly and I have noticed differences in our skin that have been pretty discouraging. You know, the inevitable signs of aging, fine lines, some wrinkles here and there, dull, dry skin, and sunspots. Thankfully, there's a non-invasive treatment available without having to go under the knife. Tasha Bryles at Lakeside Integrative in High Point, North Carolina, offers a total skin package that includes radiofrequency microneedling and laser skin resurfacing that can be done right in her office in under an hour. It stimulates collagen growth and elastin that improves the surface and texture of your skin, as well as tightening it. The laser treats acne scars, minimizes large pores, and lessens, if not completely fades, sunspots. Melody and I were blessed to get this treatment in late fall. We're going back for our after photos within a couple of weeks, and we'll be sure to post them on our Facebook group. Melody was just saying how she felt like it gave her a fresh start for her skin routine. It even cleared up some precancerous skin lesions she had, and it faded my sunspots completely as well as brightened and tightened my skin. We're really thrilled with our results. Lakeside Integrative offers an array of other services for men and women, as well as fillers, laser hair removal, weight loss, hormone, and medical treatments. Don't walk, run to the phone and call Lakeside Integrative to set up your appointment at 336-715-0007. Tell them Darlene and Melody from Hard Times and True Crime sent you. Your turn.
Okay. So with that background, on one Tuesday evening, Jim made his regular scheduled visit to the Cropsey home to visit with Nell. Nell sat with her sister Ollie on the couch, and Jim sat nearby. And there was only small talk. It was very limited. Nell, she actually had a corn on her foot that was causing her some pain. And so Jim asked her, you know, how that was doing, whether it was getting better. And Nell just replied, oh, it is a little. You know, right. She was very limited with her words. Mm-hmm. So Jim returned the next day, which he didn't always come that often. He actually had started coming a little more often recently. And he took Nell's cousin, Carrie. She was visiting from New York. And he ended up taking her skating. Some would say he might have been playing a few mind games because he was probably trying to make her a little jealous.
Yes.
Because now she's giving him the brush off a little bit. Mm. He does not like that. And when they returned from their outing, Jim came inside to visit. And he was there for about half an hour. However, Nell was writing at the time, and the two did not even speak at all during that visit. So, little tent. Jim had brought some fruit along, and Nell wouldn't take any of it. Everybody else was, like, eating the fruit. Nell was like, no, I don't care for any. But later, after he was not around, she was found eating some of the fruit. So it was during that visit that Jim told Nell's sister, Ollie, that she was a nice girl. So I did wonder if he was, like, kind of making a stab, like, your sister's not being very nice, right. But you're a nice girl. Ollie readily agreed, yes, she was indeed a nice girl. When Jim left on that day, he stopped between the dining room and then the vestibule to light a cigarette. And it was then that he overheard the sisters and their cousin talking about him behind his back. They were mocking him. And Nell had made a comment about how short he was. You said that earlier. And one of the girls, whether her sister or her cousin, I'm not sure, but one of them replied, why don't you just call him Squatty?
Oh, no.
And then they all laughed. And you know, that probably stung him quite a bit.
I'm sure.
That same Wednesday evening, Jim Wilcox returned to the house for yet another visit with Nell. So just later that evening, he came back.
Okay.
And Carrie was the one who let him in. Nell had been looking very much forward to a trip that she was getting ready to take to New York that Saturday. So she was busy mending a coat that she was planning to take along with her. There they sat, the two of them in the same room, but hardly trading two words. More awkward small talk was made, and Nell's mother offered Jim some water. He declined and then said he would not have any because she may poison it.
Oh.
So I don't know if her family was kind of getting a little tired of him, too. You said they were wondering what she kind of saw in him.
Yeah.
At some point during the evening, Roy Crawford, who you have already introduced to us as Ollie's suitor.
Right.
He told Nell she was looking mighty sweet tonight. I don't know if Ollie was offended by that or not.
Probably not, because I don't think she cared.
That's not the only strange remarks that were made. Also, someone actually brought up the topic of suicide.
Mm.
I don't know if this is just how young people entertained themselves during these courtship visits, but they got to talking about it. And Wilcox replied that he would prefer to drown. He said he had come close to it once, and it was rather a pleasant feeling.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
What a weirdo.
Because it's not a pleasant feeling. No. I've almost drowned before, and it scared me to death. But Nell, she forcefully disagreed with that opinion, and she exclaimed, no, she would rather freeze to death.
Oh, that sounds terrible, too.
I know. I'm like, doesn't everybody think about getting shot?
Right.
That's fast. And, you know, after all the bizarre suicide conversation, Jim decided it was time to head home because his mother would be looking for him. It was almost 11 and he was expected then. And I'm thinking he was 25 years old, but it was a different time. On his way out, he rolled a cigarette and asked Nell if she might join him on the porch so they could have a word in private. She got up and went out to the porch with him without a word. Ollie could hear them talking out on the porch, but she could not hear what was being said. By 11:30, Roy had decided to head home as well, and he said his goodbyes. Ollie then headed up to bed herself. When she got up to her and Nell's room, Nell was not there, but Ollie just assumed she was still outside talking with Jim on the porch, so she went on to bed. At around 12:30, there was a commotion outside. A neighbor woke the family, yelling for William Cropsey and raising the alarm that someone was trying to steal his pigs. The dogs were barking, and the whole family was awakened at this point. Ollie saw her father getting his gun, and so she quickly warned him, "Don't shoot. Nell and Jim are still out there." But once the commotion had died down, it was apparent that Nell and Jim were not in the yard or in the house, and no one knew where they were. They couldn't find them anywhere. Where was Nell?
So everyone, they got their lanterns, they're looking for Nell and Jim. They realize that the front door was left open, and that was a little bit odd. They're calling for her, they're going out by the river, nothing. It's like she just disappeared. The dad was like, "Oh my gosh, I bet that scoundrel took my daughter and they're eloping." But the mom was like, "No, there's no way," because she knew what Nell had confided in her and knew that she was really wanting to end this relationship. She just didn't think that there was any way that he would have talked her into marrying him.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like that lended some credibility to the fact that maybe at one time she did want to marry him.
And her feelings had just changed.
Yes.
Recently.
Exactly. But anyway, there were all these issues between them now. And so the family just knew something is not right. By now, William's getting frantic and decided, "I'm going to go to Jim's house. I don't care. It's late, but I got to find my daughter." And when he got there, Jim's mom, understandably, was like, "You know, what in the world? Jim is asleep." But William was like, "I do not care. Get him up because my daughter is missing." But Jim refused to see him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's
suspicious.
Shocking. Yeah. Mr. Cropsey, obviously shocked and probably just so mad, went to the police chief's house and asked him to please help him find his daughter. Okay, so they find Jim. And now where's Nell?
Exactly.
They know that he's at home.
And he's at home in the bed.
This was 1901. It was unlikely even that they would go somewhere by themselves. And I know that her sister felt really guilty for even leaving them out there by themselves.
Yes.
But they felt like they knew him, that it would be okay. But there just wasn't a whole lot of places for her to be. So this was scary. The police chief and William went back to the Wilcox residence and forced Jim out of the bed. And he seemed annoyed and surprised that they were there. It was about 3 a.m. And he said, "Look, we've been having relationship problems. And when I asked Nell to go outside with me on the porch, I was breaking up with her." He said they talked for about 10 minutes, that she took him ending their relationship really hard. He gave her back her parasol that she had wanted. And when he left her, she was still on the front porch crying. And the police chief nor Mr. Cropsey really bought his story.
Mm-mm.
They ended up bringing Jim to Nell's mother, thinking maybe she could get through to him. They actually let all of her family question him for a good bit. But the mother was just absolutely devastated, of course. And she took a hold of both of his arms and she cried and looked at him in his eyes and just begged him, "Jim, for the sake of your mother and me, please tell us where Nell is." And he said, I don't know. I'll swear to it. He's like, "I left her crying on the porch. I gave her that parasol and a photograph and I left." Now, they did find that parasol inside.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that? Like in that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was just inside the doorway, maybe in the hallway. He said that when he left Nell, he walked around for about half an hour And while he was out, he saw a friend of his named Leonard Owens. And he ended up corroborating that. Like, he really did see him. And then he said he went and got a beer and he went home and went to bed.
And can I tell you what I find suspicious about that? Mm-hmm. You know, he said he went and got a beer with that guy, but he had just told them he was leaving because his mother was expecting him home at 11.
Right.
But he didn't get home until well after 11.
Exactly.
And so I thought that was
it's suspicious. The whole thing is suspicious. Mm-hmm. So friends and family of Nell's, they made up this big search party. But of course, Jim is their number one suspect.
Mm-hmm. Right off the bat.
He's the last one to see her. And he's acting odd.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking absolutely everywhere there is to look for her. They brought in dogs and they traced her scent down to the river. The river was dragged.
Mm-hmm.
Divers were brought in. They used dynamite. Her body had sunk. They were thinking maybe that would
bring it to the surface.
Yeah. Jim, he was arrested twice in the next couple of days, but there wasn't enough evidence to hold him. At that time, they, you know, didn't even have a body. It is interesting that Jim was out hunting while everybody else was searching for her body.
All right. So when they arrested him, it was for suspicion of kidnapping. And he said he had gone out hunting because there was some heat on him in the city. And
right.
So they was kind of sent him out to the country to kind of get him away from the heat. That was
right.
What he said. And also he said he didn't look for her because this is what he told his employer.
Okay.
That he didn't look for her because if he was the one who found her, they would just blame him more and say he knew where she was the whole time.
Okay. Now, he was kind of like, danged if he did, danged if he didn't.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I mean, how many times do... I mean, we know how suspects usually are the opposite. They want to be totally involved in everything.
Yes.
And they're like overly...
I will say, I do think it's a valid excuse.
Yeah.
What he said was valid. I don't know that I buy it.
Right.
But I do think it was... I could understand because honestly, had he helped him look and had he found her, yeah, that would make him look worse.
Right.
So you're right. He was danged if he did, danged if he didn't.
Yeah. And his dad, too, had been the sheriff. He might have told him, look, don't answer any questions.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he
did. Don't go search for, you know, so some of the suspicious behavior could have been just he was being advised that way.
Right. But it wasn't a good look for him to seem so indifferent while everybody
right.
else is frantic. And he just seemed a little bit like he didn't care.
He did seem that way.
And so it was a bad look for him. Mm-hmm. But then other people later on said he was like that about everything.
And some people are, they're on.
Yeah.
We know that. We always say it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you really can't judge somebody based on their reaction to things.
That's true. But I will always say, I do it every time.
Oh,
I will still always do it.
Oh, yeah. Me too. But I do feel like a lot of killers have enough sense to act like they care.
Mm-hmm. And some of them overact.
Oh, yeah, they're overacting.
That makes me suspicious, too, mm-hmm. when somebody's overacting.
Right. But not everybody believed that Jim had something to do with her disappearance. Some thought, hey, she may have committed suicide if they had had that conversation that night. And if she had been distraught about Jim breaking up with her.
Mm-hmm.
But her family was like, absolutely not.
And he was the one, too, I read, that kind of said that kind of insinuated,
yeah.
Well, we were talking about suicide, mm-hmm. and she was upset. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
But her, you know, her mom was like, look, she was getting ready to go to this trip back to New York to see mm-hmm. some friends and family, and she was ecstatic about going. In fact, her uncle testified that Nell's trip was a big issue between her and Jim. She had told him that Wilcox was jealous and didn't want her visiting New York. He said that Nell told him in October, Uncle Andrew, I have made up my mind not to have anything more to do with him.
Mm.
Still, other people thought maybe she'd gone down to the river to think, accidentally bumped her head, fell into the water. A reward was offered, and this case was huge.
It was.
As it grew in popularity, there were multiple supposed sightings just everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And police, they followed up on them, but ultimately they weren't leading anywhere. Jim was arrested again for a third time, was given a $1,000 bond. Her father wrote an article that was published basically thanking everyone for everything that they had done for his family. And in searching for Nell, he wrote that he believes and will always believe that Jim Wilcox was guilty of whatever happened to his daughter. He said that if Nell was dead, Jim was responsible. He went on to say that sometime when this life is over, when we will stand before the great judge, we will learn how and when he murdered my daughter, and the justice he may escape here will be dealt to him there.
Mm-hmm.
Jim wrote his own article after that, kind of like as a rebuttal. Like, I can't believe he's accusing me of this. He has no reason to accuse me of this. Kind of that same song and dance he had been, like, I left her on the porch. She was crying. I was breaking up with her. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I want this mystery solved just as much as anyone else. I thought the Cropseys were friends. I believe that somebody else wrote that for him and he just signed it. Like, he was advised to write that.
Also, in that same letter from her dad, William.
Yes.
He revealed in that letter that a clue had been found, that a whiskey bottle had been found on the sand beach in front of the Cropsey home. And one of the local saloon keepers claimed, well, he had sold one just like that to Jim Wilcox.
Yes. Then one day, the Cropseys received this really strange letter postmarked from New York. And the letter said Nell had been killed because she'd accidentally seen someone that night trying to steal a pig from her dad. The writer said that Nell had been hit on the head and then dumped in the Pasqua tank. The letter even included a map that marked the spot where they said her body would be found, which her parents were like, this really shook them. I mean, to the core.
Rightfully so.
Now, the police didn't find much validity in it. For one thing, they didn't think she was in the river. They felt like they had searched pretty thoroughly.
Thoroughly.
At that point. On December 27th, though, Nell's body would be found by two fishermen in the Pasquotank River. Heartbreakingly, her mother had been sitting looking out at the river like she'd done every day since Nell had been gone. But this particular day, she saw what she called a form floating in the river by a fishing boat, but she couldn't make out what it was. She saw the fishermen tie something around it and pull it up into their boat. And later she would realize that that form had been her daughter's body.
Mm.
The fishermen saw her fully clothed body floating face down, and they pretty much knew right away who it was. News spread quickly throughout the town, and soon at least 1,000 onlookers had gathered. They called Mr. Cropsey, and he pushed his way through the people. It's said that a hush fell over the whole huge crowd as he got to his daughter's body and just was overcome with emotion. It was crazy, though, because I read in a newspaper article where her mother had been interviewed, and she said that Nell's body was as beautiful and plump as it had always been, and she looked like she was sleeping. We know what usually happens.
If you're in water for that length of time, how long had it been?
37 days.
Yeah.
And there was no real sign of decomposition, they said, except for her brain. And it was cold, but I mean, North Carolina is not that cold.
No.
I mean, this was November. Well, this was December 27th. She had gone missing, though, in November. It's not that cold. We're not in Alaska.
Like, you mean to keep the body from deteriorating?
Yeah that's right. What I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow her body had been almost perfectly preserved after 37 days of being in the river. And for the sake of her family, I'm really actually glad, because that would have been hard seeing her any other way.
That would have been terrible.
Now, her autopsy took place within a couple of hours of her body being discovered. The December 28th Post read, great crowds of people were assembled in front of the Academy of Music, which is where she loved to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the coroner's jury was in session. Groups could be seen in almost every street corner discussing the affair and awaiting the jury to announce whether the girl met with foul play or died by suicide. The coroner found a round contusion on Nell's head. There was no water found in her lungs, which meant She didn't drown. She was already dead when her body was thrown into the river. Nell's cause of death was a blow to the head. It was also mentioned that she was a virgin, and that does actually, it's a notable piece of information, I think, because of some theories that would develop later. Mm-hmm. Her funeral was held at the local Episcopal church where thousands mourned her death. It was a beautiful and terribly sad funeral. Her sisters and her mother hardly able to contain themselves. Later, she was transported back to New York and buried in the Cropsey Family Cemetery.
After her body was found, Deputy Reed went to fetch Joan Wilcox. Remember, I told you he had gone out to the country because of all of the talk about him being suspected. So Deputy Reed went out to get him. When he arrived, he informed Jim, Nell's dead, and you're going to jail for it. Mm. So he was picked up and taken back in. The community was outraged, and their anger was aimed right at Jim Wilcox. Quickly, a mob formed, and they headed to the jail with the intent to lynch Jim Wilcox for Nell's murder. Nell's father is actually the one who stopped that from happening. The night before Nell was laid to rest, that mob paid her father William a visit. They arrived with a rope meant for Jim Wilcox's neck. They wanted Nell's father to join them. They already had friends who were in the Naval Reserve. The Naval Reserve was actually guarding Jim because of the risk to his life.
Right.
But this mob had friends in the Naval Reserve who had already said they were willing to turn a blind eye if they came to break him out and hang him.
Okay.
And so that's what they intended to do, hang him from the nearest tree.
Mm.
But to his credit, William Cropsey said no to that request. He urged them to let the law take its course. William Cropsey would not take the law into his own hands on this. But years later, it was said that Mr. Cropsey regretted that decision not to act that night.
Really?
Or to at least let the other ones go ahead with their plans for justice. Mm-hmm. Even if he didn't participate in it, he regretted he'd stop them from doing it.
Okay.
Jim Wilcox was charged with first-degree murder. His trial began in mid-March of 1902. The prosecution was working on this theory, that Jim had lured Nell to the front gate that night, struck her upon the head out of his quick-tempered anger at being rebuffed.
Right.
And then carried her to the river, where he put her body on a boat and rowed out into the Pasquotank River and threw her overboard. There had even been rumors that a mystery skiff had left the shore right in front of the Cropsey home that night just after 11. But I don't think that was ever confirmed.
Okay.
Just rumors.
All right.
The biggest hurdle for Jim's lawyer to overcome was the testimony by a man named Lynn Owens. He testified on behalf of Jim that he had actually seen him that night.
Right.
A 10-minute walk from the Cropsey home. And that was 40 minutes after he had claimed to have left. So in some people's minds, that left no doubt that during that time frame, he had been murdering Nell.
Right.
So although his testimony was meant to be a defense, like, yes, I did see him, it actually cast it into a questionable light.
Right.
When Jim's trial began, he entered the courtroom wearing a short dark coat, light trousers, and a black bow tie. He was heavier than the last time the folks had caught sight of him, about 15 pounds heavier.
And on 5'3", that matters.
Yeah. And they said he must have been eating good in jail.
Yeah.
But they did say his sister Sadie was allowed to bring him meals in the jail.
Okay.
So he sure didn't miss any. He also had a noticeable receding hairline, although he was like in his early 20s.
Oh, wow.
He stood while being read the grand jury finding, indictment for murder. The jurors for the state, upon their oaths, present that James Wilcox, with force and armed feloniously, willfully and of his malice aforethought, did kill and murder Ella M. Cropsey against the statute and against the peace and dignity of the state.
Mm.
To this, Jim pleaded not guilty. The jury was selected. It consisted of a barkeep, a butcher, a mill worker, a machinist, a veneer factory owner, and 7 farmers. 10 were white men, Democrats, while the other 2 were black Republicans. The prosecution painted a picture of the murder of Nell Cropsey like no one had ever dreamed. It was a traumatic production, to be sure. Onlookers watched Jim's face closely to see if he showed any signs of guilt, but he remained stoic. Finally, it was time for the defense. Jim's attorney, Lawyer Adelette, began, and just at that time, 300 people got up and walked out of the courtroom. It was a publicity stunt to detract from the argument being presented. That was pre-planned. It was almost like a little protest walkout.
Okay.
His defense proposed that he did not have the time to commit this murder. His actions were accounted for at 11:30 when Roy Crawford had said Nell and Jim were still in the hallway. Then, Lynn Owens had claimed to have seen him at 11:40, and then again he was seen just before midnight by two others. So according to the defense, the timeline was accounted for, and there had only been a 10-minute window in which he could have murdered anybody, and they said that was not enough time to murder and then hide a body. The prosecution and the defense argued about that timeline in court. And the defense said there's no motive. Jim had been there to break things off with Nell. Why would he do that if he was planning to kill her?
Oh, I don't know. That's
true. Just his story.
That's his story.
And he's sticking to it. Yeah, there's that. He said, she said. I read a quote. He said he went there to quit her.
Right. Even if he did, if she was being hateful and condescending toward him, it might have made him mad.
Right.
I couldn't see a motive. Yeah.
Plus, he was already a little bit mad about that comment about his height.
Exactly. And I have read that he was brutally made fun of in his childhood about his height.
So
I think that was a sore spot for him.
I'm sure it was. And she probably knew that and knew which buttons to push.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though he just overheard them, they may have meant for him to overhear them. Might not have been innocent. Lastly, the defense pointed out that it was all just circumstantial evidence. There really was no hard evidence against his client. Nothing had been proven. Adelette urged the jury to be guided by reason and not by prejudice. He explained that the state's case against Jim relied on three things. One, Jim was the last person to be seen with Nell, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
Two, his conduct was against him because, how he acted aloof and indifferent.
Right.
And three, the doctor's testimony during trial. And this defense attorney admitted the first point to be correct. Jim was the last person to be seen with Nell, but he denied the other two were accurate. And he ended with this plea. In the name of eternal justice, I ask for a verdict of not guilty. And then the long-anticipated time came. The jury deliberated, and they came back with a verdict. Everyone returned to the courtroom. Jim Wilcox was found guilty of murder in the first degree. He was sentenced to be hanged by the neck until dead. But that was not the end of Jim. Remember, Adelette was a fine lawyer, and he appealed that case right away. Interestingly enough, while he's awaiting an appeal, 5 months into his stay in jail, so it was in August of 1902, an incident happened that cast him in a bad light once again.
Hmm.
One of the jailers, Mr. B.A. Newburn, had been very kind to Jim. He went out of his way many times to get whatever was asked of him to help Jim out. He was a friend to him.
Yeah.
On this particular day, Jim had asked for some matches, and Bonnie Newburn, as he was called, had went and gotten some for him. Jim was being held on an upper level of the jail, so the jailer had to kind of climb up and reach through the bars to give him the matches. And when he did that, Jim attacked him with a knife, cutting his hand pretty badly.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm thinking, where did he get a knife?
Seriously.
In the jail. And there was no reason given for the attack, only more threats toward the jailer. Bonnie then told Wilcox, when you hang, I want to be the one to pull that rope.
Right.
So,
was he trying to escape?
Not at that point. He didn't give any reason for why he lashed out at him.
Okay, well then he's unhinged.
Yeah, and where did he get this knife? He's in jail.
I mean, maybe his sister brought it to him.
In some of those meals that she was bringing?
I mean, maybe.
Perhaps.
You never know.
Well, that's not the only mark against his character. Once, when another visitor at the jail approached his cell just kind of out of curiosity, oh, I heard Jim Wilcox is in here.
You're right.
Wilcox threatened him with a beer bottle.
Wow.
So he does have that temper. He's earned that reputation. Just a couple of months later, on September 30th, 1902, The North Carolina Supreme Court awarded Wilcox a retrial. The reasons were that they awarded it was that the evidence was entirely circumstantial and that the conduct of spectators had been enough to prejudice the jury. Remember those 300 that walked out?
Yeah. Now, I don't know if this is true, but did you read that the crowd, the townspeople threatened that they better come up with a guilty verdict?
Yes, I did read that.
And that happened. I mean, we know that that has happened before in previous cases.
So that would definitely prejudice a jury.
Yeah.
On January 21st, 1903, so this was another 4 months later, Wilcox was retried in a different county this time and convicted this time of second-degree murder. So he was still convicted, but now it's just second degree.
But no hanging.
No hanging. He was sentenced to 30 years of hard labor in state prison. The Wilcox family, of course, not happy with that verdict. They felt Jim was unfairly convicted. Mm-hmm. And then the Cropsey family, on the other hand, were also not happy with that verdict, feeling that nothing short of hanging was a just verdict.
Right.
Just 1 year later, Wilcox's family was working hard to have him released. They were wanting to request a pardon from the governor already. And the Cropsey family got wind of that, and so they worked just as hard to combat that and to keep him there. But they didn't have to work too hard, because he actually helped them out with a rather stupid decision. In December of 1905, a fellow inmate contacted the superintendent of the penitentiary where Wilcox was held. He informed them that Wilcox and a fellow inmate had made an escape plan and were planning to shoot their way out of prison.
Oh my gracious.
Once the plan was found out, they were both thrown into solitary confinement for several days. When Wilcox requested a meeting with the superintendent of the prison, wanting to know why he was in there, he was told that his escape plan had been discovered. So he had nothing else to do but admit that he and his accomplice were planning that. And the superintendent said, "I heard you had some loaded guns." And Wilcox told them where to look. And sure enough, when the property was searched inside the prison, they did find two loaded revolvers hidden just where Jim Wilcox said
where
they would be.
Where are they getting these things?
I know. Weapons. I know.
Wow.
He had actually been hiding that revolver in his cell inside of a cracker box with a little cloth covering the cracker box. And then there was like some kind of like a little loop in the top of the box that the gun hung from. And that's where he kept it.
That is crazy.
But somebody snuck a gun into the guy, but he was willing to shoot and somebody.
Right.
Well, that put a quick end to any hope for a pardon for him.
Yeah.
For a while, anyway. For 13 years, little was heard from Jim Wilcox at that point. Until 1918, just weeks before Christmas, he submitted a pleading letter to Governor Bickett of North Carolina asking for a pardon. In that letter, he claimed that he had served his time faithfully without so much as a reprimand from any of the authorities. Now, I'm going,
besides the time you tried to kill.
Yeah, that you were found with two loaded guns and was going to escape. But listen, this is crazy. He said his health was bad and he desired to return home and spend Christmas with his family. He once again claimed he was innocent of the crime. The manager of the state prison also wrote a complimentary letter on behalf of Wilcox and sent it along to the governor. So on December 20th of that year, 1918, he was finally pardoned by Governor Bickett. The governor stated his reasons for pardoning as this, that Jim had been sufficiently punished for his crime already, that he had been a model prisoner. I know. And that the prosecutor of the case, the guy who had prosecuted him initially, shortly before his death, had also submitted a letter asking for Jim Wilcox to be pardoned.
I did know that.
I thought that was bizarre.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
The governor had great respect for that prosecutor, and so that held some weight with him. And he said the final thing that persuaded him was Jim's own humble letter that he had written on his own behalf. So he was pardoned and headed back home to Elizabeth City.
Yeah. So when Jim was released from prison in 1918, he, like you said, he went back to Elizabeth City where his family lived and where he had some loyal friends who had really stuck by him the whole time. Even some of the old timers who were there who thought he was guilty had softened toward him and were really willing to give him a shot at a new life. I'm sure everybody didn't feel that way, but I think most, most people were willing to give him a chance. His best friend, James Flora, got him a job working for the fire department. But it was reported that instead of those years in the prison softening gym, he was just as quarrelsome and mean as ever.
I've read that too. And that he was apparently really offensive to the other people there.
He was. And so his friend wound up having to ask for a resignation from him.
Yeah.
And Jim got, I don't know if he got depressed. I don't know which came first. I say this often, the chicken or the egg. But I know he started drinking. And he may have just always kind of had an underlying issue with drinking, because I had even heard when he was courting Nell about some inappropriate instances when he had been drinking. And so anyway, now he's drinking very heavily, kind of secluding himself. I don't think his health was that great. I'm not 100% sure he had tuberculosis, but I think that was rumored. I know that he had met with a reporter, W.O. Saunders. Well, he was an editor, and he actually did believe Jim Wilcox, and he was the only reporter that Jim Wilcox was ever willing to meet with.
Yes.
He wanted to help Jim Wilcox write a book.
And give his side of the story. Yes. So he could put his story out there.
Exactly. But this reporter wound up...
Yeah, he died in a car crash. Mm-hmm. He actually ran off into the Dismal Swamp Canal.
Yeah.
They said it was 18 feet deep. They had to dredge his car out, and it took several hours, but he took that story to his watery grave with him.
Whatever he knew, and he probably knew the most as far as Jim Wilcox's side of the story. Anyway, about July of 1934, when Jim was in his 50s, he had really just gone downhill. He had come from a prominent family, just kind of had everything laid at his feet in the beginning of his life, but he had descended.
Right.
We'll just say that. And life just wasn't going good for him. He talked to a friend of his named John Tuttle, just telling him, I don't even want to live anymore. And John's heart really went out to him. And so he just wanted to help him out. And so he took Jim into his home and gave him a room. His wife and kids were in Nag's Head, I think on holiday. That's when he moved Jim in. But anyway, he ended up staying. And when the family came back, he gave him a room in his garage. There was a bed out there and just a small little room. There was a table and a bed, just
bare basics kind of.
Yeah, exactly. So every once in a while, Jim would find odd jobs and that would earn him, said, a quarter or a half dollar. And so he didn't make that much money, and he mostly depended on his friend for food, but he drank. He had money, He drank a lot. Jim went to a church service. He went and sat down beside this woman, and she got up and moved.
Yes, she would not even sit beside of him.
Yeah.
And did you read his comment?
Go ahead.
That if that was Christianity, he wanted no part of it.
Yeah. He felt like a victim. He totally felt like he was mistreated by his community, and he sunk into this despair. But honestly, I do think he had chances when he got out of prison. I don't blame it.
I think his community was ready to, they had softened a little bit. I think they were ready to give him another chance, but I think he squandered it because he just had a horrible personality and was just not a good person.
Right. And like many, victims do, it was not his fault. He wasn't willing to take any personal responsibility. He blamed everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I read that he really played the martyr.
Yeah, he did.
And to be fair, if he did not kill Nell, and served 16 years of his life for it, you would feel a little bit like a martyr, and especially if everybody still thinks you did it. But on the other hand, it really looks like he did do it, and we know that narcissists do tend to think that everybody else is the problem.
Right, exactly. He does seem kind of classic for that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, he just kind of sought refuge in alcohol and brooded. He talked to his friends a lot about wanting to kill himself, to the point where they didn't even think that he would actually do it because he talked about it so often.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that does happen.
Okay. So a time or two, he would give away like all of his stuff. He had a spare shirt and he's like, I won't be needing this anymore. And they just felt like, okay, they're not really paying him that much attention.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, on an early Tuesday morning, Wilcox jimmied a door to John Tuttle's private office, and he took Mr. Tuttle's shotgun to his room and loaded it with two shells. A guy named Eugene Betts, which was their friend that they said, I think it sounds like a lot of guys would come there and work in this garage together. But anyway, he got there about 8:30 or 9 o'clock that morning, and Wilcox actually called him to his room. And when he came to the room, he took the shotgun that was laying beside him on the bed and put the stock between his leg and put it under his chin and then hollered out, look out, I'm going to end it. And he did. Yeah, like he ended up killing himself. And he said it didn't register with him in the beginning. Like he thought he was playing because he wasn't in there. Like he didn't see it. He was calling him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was like, oh, he's making a joke again. Because a few days before that, he had shot into the air saying he was going to do it.
Okay. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. And so, yeah.
Can I just say, I almost feel like that sounds very narcissistic as well.
Yes.
Because it's like, okay, I'm going to get all of the attention I can.
I know.
I don't know. It just sounds very...
Yeah, it really does. It's terrible. I feel bad for his friend.
Yeah.
I mean, that is actually horrible. There was quite a bit published in the newspaper bad about him. I mean, some, like I read some articles and I was like, golly.
I read those same articles, girl. One of them was so harsh. I was like, man.
One said it would have been better if he had never been born.
Yes, I read that.
That he was just, you know, let's just forget that he ever existed. I mean, it was really harsh. But then I read an article where his sister and his cousin were interviewed, and I felt bad for them because they loved him. And they said that he had just a lot of reports were written about him that weren't true. They said that Nell's father was not the one that stopped that.
I saw that.
Yeah.
But I believe that he did.
Yeah. I don't know why they said that he didn't, but I remember reading that. Oh, they're also the ones that said basically the jury was threatened that if they did not find him guilty, that they might be lynched themselves.
Yeah.
And basically, they just said the legal system really failed him, and that's a lot of the stuff that was published was really hurtful. And I'm sure it was. You know, those things would have been hard to read. But at the same time, if he killed her, and like you said, I just don't, there's not another suspect I can think of. However, there are some alternative theories.
Yes.
So you want to
You probably know these better than I know them. The one that you had read in the letter about her coming upon somebody trying to steal her dad's pig and them hitting her in the head. I did think, well, that does sound like a realistic possibility.
Yes.
Because somebody had been trying to steal the pigs.
Right.
The dogs had woken them up the second time, but I think they had been heard earlier in the evening.
Right.
So I felt like that was a valid theory. I don't really buy it, but that one sounded like it made sense to me. Then there was the one about the neighbor.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
That she was having a relationship with her married neighbor.
His last name was Fearing. I think the theory was that her dad maybe found out?
Right. And that her dad,
like, confronted the guy.
Yes. Yes. And then who was it? That the dad killed her, or that the...
That the dad, and then, okay, yeah, that the dad had something to do with it.
Yeah.
I will say, I think that Jim's family tried to make it sound like her dad did it. I think they tried to point the finger at him. But again, he would have had to have a lot of accomplices to have done such. People in their own family.
And I do not.
I do not
for
either.
One second believe. They were distraught. Yeah, I do not believe for one second that was fact.
I think he really wanted to find justice for his daughter. I do believe that.
They tried to mar her reputation.
Yes.
She was a virgin.
And the autopsy confirmed that.
Yes.
And so that I feel like that kind of does away with that whole theory. She couldn't have been having an affair with the neighbor.
Exactly.
So I feel like that's just a lot of speculation on people's parts kind of thing.
And then there was a theory that she was accidentally killed that night by maybe her sister, somebody in the house, and that they all covered for each other. Like it was an accident and they panicked. And so they just blame Jim Wilcox. To me, that is the dumbest.
That's very far-fetched.
It's so far-fetched because if it was an accident, why wouldn't you just call for help? If I accidentally did something to somebody in my family, I'm calling the cop or come help my kid.
Right. Her dad's a judge. He knows, and her uncle was a judge. They know that would be how you handle something.
Right. And then another one was Ollie's
boyfriend.
Because he had made some gestures toward her that night.
And had said, yeah, she was looking mighty sweet tonight or something like that.
Right.
And I think I even heard one theory that Ollie did it out of jealousy because Roy had said that. But again, I don't think that one holds any weight either.
I don't know. I don't think she really cared that much about him.
Oh, and then there was another crazy part of the story about the clairvoyant.
Go ahead. I don't know if I know this.
Oh, really? At one point when they were still searching for Nell, a clairvoyant by the name of Madame Snell Newman from Norfolk, Virginia, came to town claiming to know the whereabouts of Nell. She met with the police and she took them around town following her quote unquote vision of where to find Nell.
My gracious.
She said Nell had been chloroformed, wrapped in a blanket, and taken to a neighboring town and then had been killed. And her body had been left in an abandoned well by her suitor, Jim Wilcox.
Huh.
I mean, this is crazy. But authorities, you know, they didn't have a lot of leads at that time. So they followed her leads and they went all over the place looking in these abandoned wells, which, of course, they didn't find her body there. They searched all the abandoned wells within a 20-mile radius. Again, that even though that was still saying Jim Wilcox did it, it was this just crazy theory of how it all happened and made no sense.
There are a lot of little stories like that. Mm-hmm.
Which is what makes it so hard to get at the truth.
Right. I personally do believe that Jim Wilcox killed her. I just don't.
Okay. I wondered if you did. I thought you didn't.
I do.
Okay.
I mean, so I read this other book. They tried so hard to make him the victim. They were like, she was just so mean and she was just like seeing everybody behind his back. And there's just no, like zero evidence.
Right. I mean, that was a hot take, but.
Yeah. So I don't buy it. But it is interesting what ended up happening. There was so much tragedy with the people that were there that night.
So, I mean, yeah, that's that all within itself is pretty crazy.
It is.
Her brother, which I believe his name was also William.
It was.
He must have been a junior. Years later, it was 1913. This was 5 years before Jim Wilcox was ever pardoned. But her brother also committed suicide.
Yes.
In front of his wife and children by drinking carbolic acid.
Yes.
I mean, how horrible would that be? And especially with your wife and kids there. And I read that he had offered to kill them too. But some people said it was because he was carrying around guilt over something that had happened.
Right.
But again, there was really nothing that would really kind of give any credence to that. Mm-hmm. They said that he just had a lot of trouble.
He was having financial trouble, for one thing.
Yes. I think those got the best of him.
Yeah, I think so too. And then the guy who was there that night, what was his name again?
Roy.
He also committed suicide, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he committed suicide.
So bizarre.
Which is crazy. And then...
So three people that were there that night eventually committed suicide.
Yes.
Include Wilcox, Roy Crawford, and her brother William.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some bizarre. Pretty high numbers.
It really is.
Yeah.
It is. And then her sister ended up I mean, she, I don't think she ever got married.
And she became a recluse.
Yes.
And they said she kind of like was frozen in time from that night that Nell disappeared.
Yeah.
Like she never quit dressing the way, like, you know how styles change over
right.
the decades, but she never did.
Yeah.
That she just continued to dress in the style of the early 1900s and just very reclusive and odd for the yeah. rest of her life. And I believe she died in 1944, but from colon cancer, I believe yeah. it was.
She wasn't too old, I guess.
Mm-hmm. She would have been in her 60s.
Okay. And then, yeah, just such a sad, sad story.
Very.
But I do believe in the end that, I mean, I always, you know, I always pay attention to all other theories, but I do think that Jim Wilcox probably murdered her.
Yeah, I think... I know it was all circumstantial evidence,
mm-hmm.
but had I been on the jury, I think I probably would have convicted him
yeah.
or voted to convict him because he did have motive.
Right.
He did have the means.
Yes.
He did have the opportunity.
Yep.
And he was known to have a bad temper.
Right.
And that temper got away from him a couple of times, even though they said he had this model prison record. He didn't.
Mm-mm.
So I just feel like I think he was guilty.
Yeah. You know, in Elizabeth City, as a fundraiser for their city, every year they have this like event where, well, they do like a little ghost walk of the Cropsey house or around there or whatever. But then they do like a trial.
Oh.
Yeah. And a lot of times they find the dad guilty.
Ugh, I just don't believe her dad.
I do not believe it. But I, you know, later on, people just want to find all the, they want to be these sleuths and believe mm-hmm. like, oh, we have the answer.
Yeah, like so I like to do.
yeah. Well, and me too. But I think it's just like a popular new theory. He was innocent, but I don't believe he was.
Yeah, I don't either.
Those sure were some hard times.
They sure were.
Now, I'm not sure when, but at some point between 1865 and 1980, they quit calling us carpetbaggers and started calling us Yankees. Speaking of which, I got to spend a few days in New Jersey over the weekend. And when I got back, I told my wife that I had forgotten how much I liked it there. And she looked at me with that familiar glare and said, "Not enough to move there, though, right?" And I said, "No, dear, not enough to move there." If you'd like to guarantee not to disappoint your spouse by reminiscing about your childhood home, you make sure you download every episode and tell everybody you know and a few people you don't to check out Hard Times and True Crimes. Till next time, goodbye.